Jackson of Sunstone West, 2002. We'll begin with an opening prayer from Dan Witherspoon, and then I'll announce a couple of business items, and then we'll move on to our musical guest for the evening and our panelists. So, Dan.
Our Father in Heaven, we're grateful that we can meet this evening in such wonderful circumstances as friends, as Latter-day Saints and those interested in the Restoration Movement. We're grateful for the many hands and good hearts who have worked so hard to put together this event. And we pray that all of us will enjoy ourselves this next day and a half, listening to each other, listening with respect and with joy in our hearts for the diversity of people and the sincere expression of ideas that energize us all and help us consider our lives and our desires to be more complete people and to grow in all the ways that we desire. Again, we're grateful for this evening, for the panelists. We're grateful for them sharing their stories and insights with us, and pray that we'll have a wonderful time and return safely this evening and meet again tomorrow. And we do this and pray in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Two announcements. The session this evening, as well as all the sessions tomorrow, are being taped, and you will be able to buy tapes about 4 minutes or so after a session ends. They'll be duplicated that quickly, and you can purchase those, or you can take one of the tape order forms and mail in an order instead. The other announcement is that we have $5 off parking. There's a validation machine. If you bring your parking ticket into the room where we had registration, there's a stamp machine on the dialogue table next to all the Lowell Bunyan biographies. So if you want to save Letha Cannon, who is going to provide our musical numbers for this evening. So I'll let her introduce her selected songs.
Hi. I'm going to do one song for you now, and then I'm going to do a couple of songs for you a little later. But I had the opportunity of putting out a CD a few years ago, and one of the songs on this CD is based on a Leo Tolstoy story that I took a whole course on Tolstoy when I was at Stanford, but we never went over this particular short story that I only discovered years later at a New Year's Eve fireside in Haley, Idaho. When they showed a short film that was based on the Leo Tolstoy story of Where God Is, There Is Love Also. And it was the most enchanting story with such a pure message. And it was about this little Martin the cobbler who lived his life, but his wife had died, and he was just making his little shoes, and the priest comes along and leaves him a leather-bound Bible to be rebound, and he says, "Oh, I'm not worthy to do it." But he says, "No, I'm going on this journey. So you work on this until I get back." And he says, so Martin the cobbler starts reading out of this book, and he gets this sort of spiritual experience where he hears the Lord's voice saying, "Martin, look out your window tomorrow because I'm going to come visit you." And so the next day he's full of anticipation and he sees various people. He sees the street cleaner sweeping the snow, and he invites him in for some tea to warm him up, and he tells him about this great news and excitement. He keeps looking out that window and he sees a young woman with her newborn child, but they hardly have a winter coat on. He invites them in and gives them his wife's old coat, and so on and so on. And he keeps seeing these people, but he still hasn't seen the Lord. And so he's reading in the Bible again. He's really finding out all about the life of Christ. And he has another vision in the corner of his room. He sees each of these people that he had helped or visited with that day, as he looked out his window, he hears a voice going, "Martin, it is I. Martin, it is I." Anyway, I was so touched by that story. I thought, well, if Leo Tolstoy can write a story like that, maybe I can write a song version. And except mine is about Della and her 24-hour cafe. It's called Della's Cafe. Sitting at the short order counter, waiting for my stack of wings. The whole place looking empty except for Della and me. Her grin, as wide as grins go, enough to stop any show of headline news. She was married once, then twice. It never seemed to work out right. So she took to making her talents pay in the name of Della's Cafe. One day a diner left with his $2 tip, a book I only read, well worn, well dried. She read all through the night. When I was a stranger, you took me in. I was in prison, you came to me, and you gave me a reason for living. She hurled her sentences as if in a dream. Della, you've got more to live for than yourself, it seems. Keep watching as the front door opens. The people come happening on your way. Hey, hey. That day she watched for a messenger, an angel or someone like that. But all she saw was Benny, the gasoline vendor with his broken down jack, standing on the corner looking so low, looking about broken hearted. She called out, "Hey Benny, come on in. Specials only, and they laughed away the midday hour. And when he talked, he laughed and thanked her for the lovely flower she was. Still she kept watching. In came Cinderella, aspiring actress, her dreams up in smoke, and the last of her rent left her flat broke. Now Della, she knew about this, she'd say, why don't you stay with me a few days before you head back to Michigan, and you can make that last audition thing." Della read aloud, you mean, and she got a laugh. She laughed and then she heard quite a presence. She hurled her sentences as if in a dream. Yourself it seems. Keep watching as the front door opens. The things will come happening on your way. Hey, hey, mm-hmm, hey, hey. There's gonna be someone. There's gonna be someone. There's gonna be someone today at Della's Cafe. Come on down to Della's Cafe. Ooh.
well-suited for the entertainment industry, maybe in part from all those road shows that, you know, my generation was part of. However, the entertainment industry is often portrayed in LDS culture as producing only the unsettling or the unsuitable. Yet many LDS individuals work quite successfully in this environment. How do these individuals balance their working environment with their faith? And does conflict exist between the demands of the entertainment industry and personal religious values? I've asked the panelists to kind of ruminate on these ideas and also address issues such as whether they've encountered acceptance or resistance to their religious values in the workplace, how their religious background figures into the types of work that they accept or reject, whether their Mormonness has been an issue in the workplace, either positively or negatively, and do things like travel or scheduling demands have an impact on things like church attendance and participation. So what I'll go ahead and do is introduce each of the panelists to you, give a little bit of background on them, and then they'll have about 15 minutes apiece to discuss these questions and other things that might have come up for them as they prepared and, you know, talk from their niche in the entertainment industry. Our first panelist is Sean Zebarth. Currently, Sean works at Nitro Records in Huntington Beach, California. He's the one waving.
I'll wave again.
Thank you. Doing both A&R and radio promotion. He can also be heard on both KUCI and KMXN in Orange County, where he produces a weekly radio program for both stations. Sean has worked as a music director and an on-air announcer for X96, an alternative station in Salt Lake City, for 8 years. He holds an MFA in creative writing from the University of Utah and a bachelor's in English from BYU, where he spent the better part of his time running around with other heathen student reviewers. Sean is married to Elisa Ashby Zebarth, and they have 2 children. Our next panelist is Christopher Utley, also waving. Chris's entertainment experience spans broadly between management, development, and performance. Chris was recently promoted to entertainment show director after spending 2 years as a producer and 3 years as a manager of show development. And I might say that his employer is someplace you might recognize. It's that tiny little theme park in Anaheim, happiest place on earth. His previous Disneyland entertainment positions include manager of entertainment cast development, entertainment art area supervisor, and guest talent assistant. When his schedule permits, Chris participates in local theater productions, most recently appearing in the Laguna Playhouse production of Travels with My Aunt. In April of 1985, Brigham Young University awarded Chris a Bachelor of Arts in Theater and Cinematic Arts, summa cum laude. He subsequently received his MBA from the Walter A. Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley, graduating in May 1990 as valedictorian. He's been head of a number of Disney projects, and he speaks fluent Mandarin Chinese, and there's one other thing that caught my eye on the bio. Let's see. Conducted East 27th Street Wolverines Jazz Band, among other talents. Our next panelist is Linda Love Simmons, a show director and choreographer, waving. You guys are so helpful in pointing yourselves out on the panel here. Through her great energy as a performer and her imaginative creations as a director and choreographer, Linda Love Simmons has had a great effect on the world of live entertainment. Originally from Los Angeles, Linda's work has been seen at theme parks, on television, and on stages across the country. Ms. Simmons directs and choreographs for such well-known companies as the Radio City Music Hall Rockettes, Holland America Cruise Lines, Stiletto Entertainment, V Corporation Sesame Street Live, Paramount Theme Parks, and Disney. Her very diverse background has allowed her to choreograph and direct a wide range of styles, from classical ballet and modern to MTV-style jazz and musical theater. She has also directed and choreographed the 2002 Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City. Anybody catch that? her passion for her work is always an inspiration with those she works with. For the Walt Disney Company, Linda has worked on scores of special events and shows, including the Hercules Electric Light Parade in New York, Mickey's Hometown Tour, the Christmas Fantasy Parade, and head choreographer for Eureka, a California parade at Disney's California Adventure. Currently in the park, Ms. Love Simmons choreographed and was the assistant director on Calling All Space Scouts, a Buzz Lightyear adventure. Brett Simmons, also waving. Brett's songwriting talents have taken him from Los Angeles to Nashville to Tokyo. His talents as a composer, arranger, music producer, musical director, vocal coach, and keyboard artist have brought him success with such entertainment giants as the Walt Disney Company, Sony Records, MGM Television, Universal Television, NBC, ESPN, EMI Music Publishing, Famous Music Corp., and Al Gallico Music Corp. Did I get that right? All right. Brett's musical gifts and styles embrace the excitement and passion of musical theater, the infectious rhythm of pop, the emotional sounds of country, and the timelessness of classical. His original song, You Got Me, on Sony Records, and the hugely successful international touring show Camp Disney became sensations with Japanese audiences of all ages. Some of his domestic and international credits include the 2002 Salt Lake Winter Olympics, surprise, Disney's Lumen Aria, a Special Olympics tribute featuring Cliff Robertson, Fame, Charles in Charge, Jack A., Mickey's Hometown Parade, and the world-famous The Golden Horseshoe Jamboree at Disneyland. Quite a crowd we have up here tonight. And our last panelist, David Howard, just waved. After laboring in obscurity for more than 10 years, David Howard became an overnight success when his spec script Captain Starshine was produced by DreamWorks and under the title Galaxy Quest. You might have heard of that. Before that, however, Mr. Howard has worked extensively in theater, having had plays produced with such theaters as Actors Theater of Louisville, the Moving Arts Theater, and Timescape Arts Group. His play Electric Roses has been published in anthologies of plays by Samuel French Books and Smith & Krauss Publishers. Recently, he developed a television series pilot with Ron Howard's Imagine Television for the WB Network. David is a native of Utah. He received a BA from Southern Utah State College in theater, where he acted two summers with the Utah Shakespearean Festival, and a Master of Arts from Penn State University while he was still on his acting kick, and an MFA in playwriting from the University of Utah. He realizes he spent more time in school than is healthy for any thinking individual, but concluded that it was a lot easier to write in obscurity with the aid of student loans and assistantships than being bogged down with making a living. He lives in Valencia, California with his lovely wife Bonnie and their four adorable children. So I'll go ahead and turn the time over to the panelists, and after they are through giving their respective spiels, we'll open the floor for audience question and answer.
I'm going to watch the parade. Well, some of the cast members didn't like us standing there and, you know, vehemently opposed to us standing right there, so I got mad at them. I almost got kicked out of Disneyland. So next time I want some, like, pass from you guys, if you could work that.
We have no power.
No. Well, either do I, so. Shall I give my background? My background's mostly in radio. I was the music director in Salt Lake City, where I was in charge of some of the programming, and I was also an on-air announcer, and I work for a record label. So that's kind of a reminder of where my background's from. But I thought I'd start off talking a little bit about my work environment. And currently it's working in an office for most of the day and working with office people, and the only thing that's at odds with my belief system is, you know, the Mr. Coffee machine that we just got. And people always notice who doesn't drink coffee, and so it's always, oh, wait, you used to work in Salt Lake, you don't drink coffee, are you Mormon? Yeah, so they figured that out pretty quick. There's also a woman that I work with, and she's a very colorful young lady, is into, lots of, she's just the opposite of what you would assume a Mormon is, and she likes devil stuff and overt sexual stuff. So when I take my kids to my office, I have to put up things in the way of her posters that she has on her wall. So that's kind of my work environment. But it's pretty, you know, any like any other normal environment. Where it gets a little bit sticky as far as my beliefs and my values is when you're kind of in the building relationships of trust mode. As radio promotion, I have to basically sell radio stations on the bands that our label releases. And when I was in radio, people sold me on the stuff. So, and in the world of, you know, the record business, it's building relationships of trust is most easily done, not the least expensive way, but it's easily done in parties. So there's lots of parties, lots of open bars, lots of drinking. The guys like to go out to strip clubs and, you know, and hey, buddy, buddy, let's go watch the girls and the pasties, and then they're best buddies and they'll play their music. So that's where it gets a little bit sticky. There's also, I'm going to tell you how I balance that soon, okay? Stay tuned. There's also a lot of like little junkets, or, you know, we'll go snowboarding trips and stuff, and the kind of party college atmosphere, these radio people never really grow up, and they get paid for never having to grow up and continue to party. So that's my work environment. Now, how do I balance that environment with my faith? There's not really any balancing going on. When everybody goes to the strip clubs, Sean goes back to his hotel with a good book. When there's, you know, parties, open bars, I choose, you know, not to partake of the things that I just, you know, I don't do what I don't do. So, you know, I'm drinking a Diet Coke, or if I'm really feeling crazy, a virgin pina colada. And of course, that's what really gets, you know, gets me weird looks. So basically, I just, you know, just do my own thing, and it, people do recognize that, and they do want to know why I'm not choosing to do those things. And with the Salt Lake connection, religion always comes up. So, like I said, there's no real balancing. Where, when I was in radio, and when people were coming to me and selling me on things and trying to build relationships of trust with me, they kind of have to conform to me. And it's kind of an easy situation, because if you say, you know, you like to read, and, you know, they're always doing their hey, wow shtick and talking about the ladies and how they like to smoke the weed, and then they don't get the usual response from me, so it's then they kind of clean up their act a little bit. But it's a little difficult now, because as I am working with radio stations or bands, or, you know, rock bands that we're trying to sign, I'm in the position of kind of conforming to them. So I have to work a little bit harder at finding things that I could relate to with these people that aren't their usual daily activities of whatever it is they do, and I don't really want to know. And so it's a little bit of a challenge, and I do have to work a little bit harder to build those relationships. Just kind of an example of a situation I was in. Me and my boss took a radio music director in Portland out to dinner. He invited his friend, and usually what happens, you go to dinner, and then you go out and have fun and party and do that whole thing. So they were talking about some club that they always like to go to, and they kind of asked us, yeah, so what are you guys doing afterwards? And so, oh, we saw this really great bookstore down the street. We wanted to go check that out. And their jaws, like, literally dropped. They're like, oh, all right. And the dinner kind of got wrapped up pretty quick, and we went our separate ways. So you just kind of put your foot down, and they do what they do, and I do what I do, and ne'er the twain shall meet. I think where the conflict lies is not so much it's more in the culture of the recording industry and the LDS culture, where, you know, I'm hanging out with guys with tattoos and earrings, and is that necessarily, you know, against the gospel of Jesus Christ? No, but it's not in our culture. So I think that's where most of the conflict comes up, is the LDS culture, and most Latter-day Saints are, you know, well-groomed and well-dressed, and they smell nice, and rock bands aren't and don't. So that's where the conflict lies. And so I always think of the, when I'm at a show or in a particular place, the Sunday school lesson of standing in holy places always kind of flashes by my eyes, like, most people in my ward don't think this is a holy place. So another example of that is when I was in Salt Lake, I also, I was a DJ at clubs, and I would DJ at dance clubs, and I'd play music with loud, obnoxious beats, and people would dance to it and drink to it, and they had lots of fun. So I would do that at, you know, till 1:30 in the morning, because in Salt Lake it's still not that crazy. They got to close the bars down at 1:30. So the next day I was in Elders Quorum, and the lesson was on the word of wisdom, and they kind of brought up this: we have to stand in holy places, and we have to avoid places like bars and dance clubs, because it's just the wrong atmosphere, and it kind of leads to that. And in my mind, I'm thinking, dude, I was providing that atmosphere last night. So I don't really have. So I don't see that as a conflict. It's just more of a difference in cultures. And anyway, I kind of like to say, be in the industry, but not of the industry. One of the questions we had is, do I encounter acceptance or resistance? Dave, are you cheating and reading this, David? You're supposed to listen. Just kidding. You're welcome to read along. I really don't get any resistance to my religious values in the workplace. Especially here in California, it doesn't. It's actually, they're actually very open to it, and I get a lot of questions, and I get many opportunities to kind of share the gospel and share my beliefs, and everybody's, you know, really interested. I've handed out several Book of Mormons at work, and so I don't get any resistance there. Now, ironically, the resistance I did get is when I lived and worked in Utah, because in Utah, it's black and white. It's the Mormons and it's the not Mormons, and everything's an issue, and it's just, there's no gray area. It's just, you're either a Mormon or you're not, and you're either so it's that's where I would get a lot of resistance, is at the radio station I worked in. For the most part, there were only two practicing Latter-day Saints. The others were either cultural or just out of it, and there was one Catholic guy who grew up in Ogden. I think he was like space alien or something. But and where the resist, it wasn't even so much resistance. It was a lot of mocking and, you know, making fun of. I walked into a staff meeting one time, and they're talking about the name Alma, and they were saying how, you know, oh, this and the, I don't know what they were saying. And I'm kind of in there and kind of, no, this is, it's a Spanish name. Sometimes it's a woman's name. But then I'm realizing, oh, the guy that I work with is telling the other guy, our staff, what his temple name is. And I'm just like going, oh, okay. And this is the same guy who would take the name of the Lord in vain over and over again in every conceivable way, because our boss, our Catholic guy, did it. And he just thought that was the craziest thing and a lot of fun. So it was mostly, not really resistance, but just a lot of kind of mocking and, you know, that kind of culture. I just have to tell this story. Like I said, everybody kind of figures out I'm Mormon pretty quick with the no drinking, no coffee, Salt Lake City. So one time we were at a music convention, South by Southwest in Austin, and this guy introduced myself and a friend who was also from Salt Lake, and said, "Oh, these guys are, you know, Sean and Sam. They're from Salt Lake City." And she's sitting there smoking a cigarette, and she's like, "Oh, you're from Salt Lake. Are you Mormon?" And we're like, "Yeah, we are." She's like, "I feel so decadent." So it's this, you know, I don't know what kind of, you know, people have these weird assumptions about Latter-day Saints, and when they meet one, they, you know, and we're halfway normal, they just kind of freak out. Does my religious background figure into the type of work I accept or reject? And it's hard to say because my taste in art or my aesthetic sense is, it has to be somewhat influenced by my beliefs and my religious upbringing, but there are many other things that are a big influence, like just my education or my experience. And I don't think that my aesthetic is necessarily unique to me as a Mormon. I share, you know, the same kind of aesthetic sense with many people in my industry. So a lot of it is just, is it good music or is it bad music? Is it something that we could sell? Is it something that we like personally, or is it not? And I'll get something that's all, you know, one extreme of 666 devil stuff, and there's a lot of bands into that, and I just kind of look at it and go, and it doesn't really faze me. But then I do the same thing when we get these Christian rock bands, which are getting very popular, and they're thanking God and every other thing, and they're just wearing God and Jesus on their sleeves, like it's, you know, it's just like, but it's just the polar opposites, and both sides are just kind of like, just kind of odd to me. So I don't think figure into it. It's more of a business thing or more of a personal taste of what kind of music I would accept at the label or to play at the radio station. The one time it did kind of figure in is actually when I was offered this job at the current label I work for. There's a band called Guttermouth, and they're called Guttermouth with a very good reason. There's actually an LDS guy in the band, and as I was, you know, thinking about going to work at this company, I thought, well, I should, you know, look at some of this music, listen a little bit closer. And one of the Guttermouth songs was singing about, you know, and they're very funny, it's all in a ha-ha way, but, you know, the whole song is about, you know, this guy was trying to convince his girlfriend into getting an abortion. And I was like, wow, that's, you know, pretty intense, and I don't know if I'd want my 12-year-old kid listening to that. And so I asked my wife, I said, "Elisa, would you read these lyrics?" And she kind of reasoned, like, "Do you care if I go work for a label that we, you know, put out music like that?" And she's like, "No, I don't care. Are they going to pay you? Let's go." So it's Elisa's fault. But the good luck shined down upon from the heavens, because as soon as I got there, the band, like, left the label, and so we didn't ever have to deal with them. So it was a good choice. And I just kind of noticed, having to do with, like, the artwork and what we would accept or reject, kind of noticed something recently in kind of my studying of the Articles of Faith. The 13th Article of Faith, we hear this all the time, especially having to do with the entertainment, and, or, you know, with art. It ends, "If there is anything virtuous, lovely, or of good report, or praiseworthy, we seek after these things." Everybody always connects the two. They always focus on the virtuous and lovely, meaning it has to be beautiful, and it has to be pretty, and it has to be sunshiny, or else we don't seek after it. But there's a big or there. Virtuous, lovely, or of good report, or praiseworthy. So art and music can be of good report and praiseworthy, but not necessarily sunshiny and happy and testimony building. But I just thought I'd throw that in there. Anyway, I think my Mormonness, it's, like I said, it's mostly just a positive in the workplace. My traveling and or scheduling demands, you know, I sometimes have to go to shows on Sundays. I'll sometimes have to be you know, on the air and radio, I figure it's like a policeman. It's like, man, if those kids don't have their rock and roll, you know, there could be problems. I need to work on Sundays sometimes. But I try not to miss church. I try to, you know, revolve everything around church. So I don't usually miss church, and I'm in the young men's, and I'll sometimes miss out on activities, but then I take them to concerts and give them to free CDs, and they seem fine with that. So there's my story. There you go. The Simmons are next. Oh, Utley, you.
All right. Just on an administrative note, I was surprised to find out that we are being recorded, so that's fine, but I will say that my remarks are off the record for anything other than your home use and edification. Further, I want to clarify, because all of those bios and intros sounded, they were very, very nice sounding, but I want everyone to understand where I fit into the entertainment industry. There's a very tiny corner where you'll find me standing, and the rest of the entertainment industry is out here. So I perceive myself having some great experience, but I sit in a little tiny corner called theme park entertainment. Have had some great experiences, and in fact, most of my comments tonight will relate to my work and my goals as an actor as opposed to a show director at Disneyland. It's intriguing because as I read the notes in the program as far as what we were to be discussing, I too made the observation that a lot of what I deal with in the workplace is no more unique than what I would deal with in any workplace. I spent a couple of years working for a software firm, actually, after attending Berkeley. And my balance of the gospel and the workplace was no different there than it is at Disneyland. I encounter the same issues. I deal with the same variety of people with variety of moral backgrounds. It's interesting, however, that the entertainment industry, because it's so public and out there and vocal, that there's this measure of intrigue that you kind of look at it and say, look at those lifestyles. And even as a young boy, very little, when I knew that I wanted to be a part of the entertainment industry, my dad looked down and counseled me, you don't want to be a part of that industry. You don't want to live that kind of a life. So it's always had this image of a lifestyle that did not coincide with the gospel. So again, I'll quickly go over some of these. We all had the same questions, and I won't dwell on it because you've already heard my answers. How do you balance the working environment? Same way as anybody, as any of you, with lots of faith and prayer. You build a testimony, you make your decisions based on your testimony. Does conflict exist between the demands of the entertainment industry, personal religious values? I'll come back to this, but I believe that conflict does not exist between the demands of entertainment and the demands of my personal religious values. There is conflict between some of the personnel and some of the more vocal individuals in the industry, but again, that's just like any industry. Religious values accepted or rejected? Sure. In the workplace, I also get lots of questions, but I also have just as many opportunities to pass out conference tapes, which I did the other day. A gal in her religion was talking about tithing, and I had a conference tape that Elder Holland spoke about tithing and had a great opportunity to give that. So they know that I'm a member of the church, that I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints over at Disneyland. There are expectations of my behavior, but it's not an issue. So turning away from that, for me, a more interesting topic is my work as an actor. And it sounds like you had your... you're done with that. I'm kind of just starting up again. And I'm getting back into it after having been away a little bit. And I'm enjoying that, and probably when I get through all of my comments, one of the overriding gospel questions for an actor is, what roles do I take and what roles do I turn down? I've done work in commercials, a little bit of television, a lot of theater. That's what my degree is in, as you heard. Let's start with commercials. When I secured an agent, I made it very clear that there are certain products I will not advertise. Those include, as you can guess, alcohol, tobacco, coffee, tea, the lottery, casinos, etc. The amazing thing was they said, great, just remind us if we send you out on one of those. There was in the back of my mind a small concern that if I exclude myself from those types of commercials, am I cutting out a big chunk of opportunity? I don't think so. Two reasons. USAtoday.com conducted a survey asking participants to name what they believe are the top 10 commercials of all time. Of those 10, only two of them were related to beer. The rest of them were commercials that I myself would audition for. So am I missing out on 2/10 of the best commercials of all time? I'm okay with that. Additionally, I believe also by saying no and sticking to my values that it's just like paying tithing. When I say no and I obey the gospel as I obey it, as I am comfortable with it, opportunities will open up for me. And that has happened. So I'm not worried about that. Film and television gets a little more challenging because commercials, there's not too much objectionable. As I am now building my career in film and television, here are a couple statistics for you. The Motion Picture Association of America, which attaches ratings to films, in the year 2001 attached an R rating to 67% of the films which they rated. 22% received a rating of PG-13, 7% a rating of PG, and 4% of the films released in 2001 received a rating of G. Okay, now, actor guy, does that mean that I only audition for 11 or 12% of films that are produced and reduce my chances for a career in the industry? The statistics are fairly consistent with what I just told you and have been fairly consistent since about 1995. So it's really holding steady. It makes the decision-making process a little difficult. Other things that make the decision-making process difficult are, for example, the recent praise and adulation that a certain actress received, a certain Academy Award-winning actress received, for her brave and daring performance in, what's it called?
Monsters Ball.
And they couldn't say enough about it. And they interviewed her boyfriend. Oh, it's just, I was so proud of her. She was so courageous. That's a message that's being communicated. Makes it challenging for me to now take my values and try to squeeze them into what appears to be a very immoral industry. Again, remember, these are the voices that we are hearing that are very public. Other issues when you raise the question, well, you know, I just don't want to do that kind of a scene. Oh, but it's real. It's real life. And we need our audiences to just feel that and vicariously go through that because that's what it's all about. Okay, well, we'll come back to that too. Travels with My Aunt that was mentioned, the piece I did at Laguna Playhouse, was offered a role. The character used some profanity that I was not comfortable with. And when I was offered the role, I made it clear to the director that I was not comfortable with that and didn't want to say that line. His first response was, well, actually, I think he first said, well, okay. But then he followed up with, yeah, but this is theater. Okay. I say that with a little edge, although I don't criticize his response too much because there's some validity to what he said, but we'll come to that. I cut this down from an hour and a half, so just, you know.
Okay.
thank you.
All right, we'll now be reading 2 Nephi. All right, so again, actor guys out there, those questions, is it appropriate, do I accept a role in a film that our general authorities and our prophet counsels us that we shouldn't even attend as an audience member? Is it appropriate for me to appear in one of those films?
They didn't say you couldn't appear in one. They just said don't go
to them. Don't go to them. Exactly. The letter of the law. There was a character in a film that was just... speaking evil, speaking out against deity, defying God. And I had also seen this film up in Oakland. I saw a live performance in Salt Lake. We'll just let that sit there for a minute. You know, San Diego, Oakland, Salt Lake, hopefully Newport Beach. So what types of roles is it appropriate to accept? And I guess so far in my life, these questions need to be answered on a case-by-case basis. What's the message? What's being portrayed? What's the take-home message? What are people going away with? Which comes to the question, why do I act and subject myself to these choices? When I go, one of the things I said I would get to, I'm now getting to, we talked about conflict existing between the demands of entertainment and personal religious values. And I said that I don't believe that conflict exists between the demands of entertainment and personal religious values. I believe that the demands of entertainment are to cause and elicit an emotional reaction in the audience. That's why the audience goes to the theater, to the cinema, to experience laughter or sadness or anger or frustration. We go to the theater to have some type of emotional experience, and it's the actor's job to provide that. By being real, by presenting reality, again, I go back to this guy's comment, it's real life. It's theater. And I think those are valid and good. Those are good reasons to participate and go to the theater. The theater is an excellent place to educate and to create those emotional experiences with the audience as well as the actors. It's very liberating and cathartic and satisfying to act out anger, sadness, sorrow, without sinning. Travels with my aunt. I portrayed a dog. And the dog, there's a scene where the dog was afraid of losing his master and hopped up, hopped up and act like a dog.
On their leg?
No, I need to explain because it wasn't that, and I don't want to steer you down the wrong path. I won't dig the hole in the... There wasn't that, no.
Okay, sorry.
Okay. Golden Boy. To portray the evil, slimy fight promoter in Golden Boy who was just exploiting the young fighter, and just to be able to be Mr. Slimy Guy that I would never be in real life. The angry son in Skin of Our Teeth who sits there challenging his father to shoot me right now and just to kind of exude this rebellious spirit that... We were talking again earlier that growing up, I never felt really allowed to behave in that rebellious or angry or that way. I auditioned for a commercial that required spontaneous crying. I'm not real good at that. I didn't get the part, but... But it was, I remember after that, I got myself all worked up, and I remember driving home thinking just how satisfying it was and how relaxing it was to have had that emotion inside and let that go and feel free to release what's on the inside. So that's why I do it, because it's fun. It's fun to do stuff and to be stuff without really doing it and getting in trouble for it. At Disneyland a few weeks ago, I was able to dress up like Jasmine. and cross-dress without really being a cross-dresser. It was all entertainment. Okay, so wrapping this up, I guess. The entertainment industry is full of influence that are contrary to the gospel. Great. Well, the world is full of influences that are contrary to the gospel. We live in the world. This is, I love, you know, be in the industry, not of the industry. On the way up here, we talked about going to parties. The party, the Hollywood party. I've been to one. And there was drinking and smoking and girls walking around with beers. But it was a microcosm of the world. Why can't I be a shining light, just like I am walking down the street or going to work every day, in the entertainment industry? That's my responsibility. We must live the gospel. I'm entertainment to connect with an audience. I've seen how entertainment can touch an audience member and effectively change their life. That feeling, that rewarding feeling, is so amazing when you're in tune with the gospel and you're living the gospel that you're comfortable with and you're doing your best and you make that connection with an audience member. It's amazing. So the last thing I have here is, as a director at Disneyland, where it's a little easier because we're providing family entertainment, so there's really no expectation to push the envelope into the land of inappropriate. So as an actor, I continually evaluate the demands of the actual entertainment versus the demand of the people in entertainment and what may be expected. And when I select a role, I measure the value of that role in fulfilling the demands of entertainment and eliciting that emotional response. And if the end result, if that emotional response and connection is consistent with unchangeable truths of the gospel, then I'm likely to take that role, whether it's the good guy or the bad guy. The end.
First, I need to say that what I did with the Olympics is I was the assistant director and choreographer of all the atmosphere talent, and so I didn't do the opening or closing ceremonies. That's the most commonly answered question. And what that meant is I had 27 shows and 300 performers at every venue doing every possible thing, from NSYNC to 60 shows to marching bands to everything in the world. So that's what I did for the Olympics. Just that. It's a small thing. I kept saying, now I want to do something big. Joseph Chilton Pierce writes, "We must accept that this creative pulse within us is God's creative pulse itself. As a dancer, my first introduction to the church was my dance teacher, who was a Latter-day Saint. So for me, dancing and performing has always been a very spiritual byproduct. There's something that happens when the stars align and our movement aligns and the choreography aligns and there's an audience and it's your ego is right and it's just right, that as performers we have an opportunity to transcend our humanness and we truly do feel spirit. And that's an amazing feeling. And when that happens, it's like that, you know, you gotta have it. You just gotta keep having it. And that's how it was for me. I started experiencing those transcendence moments, that feeling of being able to be a great creator at a very early age, at about 14. So I couldn't not go into performing. As hard as I tried, I was pre-med my first 2 years at BYU. I loved the anatomy. That cadaver stuff was cool. So I really thought I wanted to be a doctor, but I couldn't fit in all the science classes because I was taking too many dance classes and touring with the Young Ambassadors and doing all of this crazy stuff. And so after my second year at Brigham Young University, I quit school and I was hired to dance in the Corps de Ballet for National Ballet. I did that for a little bit of time and then started doing equity theater, transitioned more into musical theater, which was really what I loved to do. But they told me I would never be a good ballet dancer and I had to prove someone wrong. I'm a little ornery that way. So I did musical theater. Up to this point, I have to say that I'd only been a member of the church for a year and a half. So I did start to lose sight of my values. And I remember looking in the mirror at myself one day, and I was 20, going, "Woo, I look like I'm about 35. I was starting to go away, you know, who I was and what my spirit was. And I was a shell of the artist that I had been previously. So I was sick mentally and emotionally and spiritually. And so I packed my bags and I went back to BYU because I needed to immerse myself around a lot of Latter-day Saints. That just helped me. That's what my spirit needed. I was a rare fish. I came back to BYU and I was a freak of nature because I'd worked professionally. I danced in ballet companies. I was dating a guy who said, "Well, I was engaged." And he said, "I want you to be like my mom." And I said, "Well, your mom got married at 18 and had her first baby at 18 and 9 months, and I'm 22 and I already have a career. I can't be your mom." He goes, "Well, then we're breaking up." I said, "Good, because I don't like you anymore." So I had a lot of really cool opportunities at BYU because of that, and I directed and choreographed. And my last two semesters, I was on scholarship with every department, the opera department, the theater department, the dance department, and the music department, because they all wanted me to choreograph things for them. And I had learned to be a good businesswoman. And I said, "Well, you're not going to pay me, so, but fork over the scholarship money." You know, if you don't learn one thing, you'll learn how to pay your bills. That and selling my electric curlers once a month. Anyway, I had great experiences. I graduated from BYU and then got married. I said I would never be married at BYU, so I graduated on Friday and got married on Saturday. We moved to Los Angeles, and as I started that phase of my career, I made different choices. I chose not to audition for shows that toured or went out of town. I chose not to be away from home for a long time. And did that decrease the amount of work that I probably could have gotten? Most definitely, because the type of dancer I am is cruise ship girl. You know what I mean? I probably could have done cruise ships for 1,000 years, and short cruise ships. And you know, Disney, that's kind of the whole gig. I never really had to struggle with being cast in girly shows because that's just not the kind of person that people saw me as. As a matter of fact, the one musical I wanted to be in more than I wanted to breathe was the musical A Chorus Line, because that was the musical that changed my life. I saw it when I was 11, and I said, "That's what I want to be when I grow up." I was called back for the role of Val, meaning that I had to say the most raunchy words and sing the most raunchy words in the whole show, but I didn't care because I wanted a part, okay? So maybe I don't have a testimony, but I really wanted a part. So I went and I read for it, and the director loved me. He laughed his head off and he said, "You're perfect. You're so funny. You're so cute. You would be adorable." He said, "Linda, I know you. And I could not sit and listen to you talk this way 8 shows a week. It's just not you." And so, see, I was blessed, even though I was evil. But I still would have taken the part. Let's be honest. So anyway, I was heartbroken. But you know what? 3 days later, I got called to be Bibi Benzenheimer, which is the part that I am absolutely perfect for. It is my life story. That's the role I should have played. And so I did that, and it was an awesome experience. I kept performing. I had 2 children, and after my second child was born, it was too hard. It was too hard to go to auditions and too hard to find babysitting and too hard. So I stopped. And I said, "I'm just going to stay home. I'm just going to stay home." That lasted about 8 weeks. And I can't help it. I'm a freak. It's just something that I have to do. So I started teaching dance and coaching competitive dance 1 day a week. And in a month, it was 2 days a week. and in 6 months it was 4 days a week. In a year it was 6 days a week. And I was busting my bum, and I was working so hard, but I wasn't getting anything back because I didn't want to coach people who were doing what I should have been doing. It was too hard for me. They didn't understand the passion and the intensity with which I did my work, and so I was constantly screaming at them, going, "Don't you get it?" You know, I was just mean, and their parents were very angry to have me teach their daughters. So I had to stop doing that. At 33, I went back to performing and started to transition into doing choreography, which I had always done, and people had always said to me my whole life, "That's your gift. You are a choreographer. That's your gift." And from the moment I started dancing, when I hear music, I see music. I don't hear it. It moves for me. I can squint my eyes, and I can see patterns and shapes, and it's just how I see. It's how I hear music. It moves. And aren't I lucky that I married a composer? And so Brahms writes, "I felt straight away... straight away the ideas flow upon me directly from God." And that is how choreography was for me. I could hear music and I was quick. And and the minute I said yes to what I believe is my divine destiny and what has proven to be my divine destiny, I have not worked in 6 years. So it's been constant. Chris Utley did give me my first job at Disneyland. We like to help each other that way. But once I transitioned to a choreographer, to be honest with you, that's when the challenges began for me. Because Leslie McIntyre writes, "Nobody objects to a woman being a good writer, sculptor, or geneticist, or in my case, a choreographer, if at the same time she manages to be a good wife, a good mother, good-looking, good-tempered, well-groomed, and unaggressive." Well, I am all of these things. I am all of these things sometimes, but I'm never all of these things at the same time. And when I was choreographing the Eureka Parade at Disneyland, I was 9 months pregnant. The parade opened on January 7th, and I had the baby the 10th, which is a great dancer story. You have to understand, dancers love war stories. So my husband says, "That's a great one." Anyway, I remember saying to screaming at dancers, going, "I'm 9 months pregnant. I could kick higher than you. What part of dancing full out do you not understand?" You know, and the director and all the other people on the team, none of which were women or married or
straight.
said, "She's just hormonal." I said, I swear, I think my head must have exploded. I said, "I am not. If you talked this way, you would," you know. So I went into my whole, 1976 women lib thing. So, still, I believe that the intense desire that I had to be in my career and do my craft was God talking through me. I was given a gift, and it was my responsibility to do good with that gift and to be a part of it, even when all the odds were kind of against it. Actually, I will have to say that I've gotten a lot of jobs because I'm nice. I'm organized. I'm the most hyper-psycho-organized human that ever lived on the planet. And that's probably why my husband, when I come home from job, say, "We are not your cast." Stop timelining us. When I cook Thanksgiving dinner, the turkey goes in at 5:07. The gravy is, have it all timed out because it's the only way that I can make it happen. So I received the job choreographing the Electric Light Parade, which was the Hercules opening in New York City, because the director wanted someone nice on his team. I got the job at the Olympics because Sarah Wiseman, the producer, said, "Not only are you extremely creative, you are the most organized person I will ever meet, and the only way that we can get 27 atmosphere shows to 17 venues is to have somebody who can do everything." So I'm, screaming at Brett, "I need music," and I'm arranging, I'm helping this guy with this funky horn thing do his play the horn. I'm bossing everyone around. Basically, I'm just Lucy and Charlie Brown, kind of bossy. The point is that I'm able to balance it about 85% of the time. and 15% of the time I'm in the corner in a fetal position going, it's too much, I can't do it. You know, but I have an amazing supportive husband. I have children who have grown up in the business, so they understand artist mentality. They do. They're already there. You know, my 11-year-old says to me, Mom, I love to dance to Christian music because that is my religion. She's so dramatic. I think, oh my gosh, I've created a freak. She's actually just like I am. The scary thing for me is that oftentimes I think the judgment that I experience is probably, as talking to Chris, is self-inflicted through members of the church. I think that my first book that I read was A Woman's Divine Destiny. And I read that book and I thought, I'm never going to be that. I'm never going to measure up. And so sometimes I struggle with that I'm not the typical, you know, mom that does all these things. And my youngest daughter said, when are you going to be a normal mom? And I said, when are you going to be a normal kid? Normal kids, moms, don't take their kids to New York, and you don't know all the characters at Disneyland, and you don't, you know, get to do all this other great stuff. Oh yeah, I like that stuff. So the hardest thing for me is sometimes I feel like I don't fit the mold. But in reality, when I evaluate that, I recognize that there is no mold. Thank goodness, would we be so boring. And that my contribution is to create as much goodness and light in what I do every day, to try to lift the people I work with. My favorite quote in the world is Martha Graham, and she writes, there is a life force, an energy, a quickening that is translated through you into action. And because there is only one of you in all time, this expression is unique. And if you block it, it will never exist through any other medium and will be lost. So I took that as I read that quote, I recognize the fact that it is my responsibility to be true to who I am, even if it's not like someone else. And to accept that I'm a psycho-hyper, you know, timeline my family, and luckily I have a husband who's really cash about it, and, you know, and I do what I do, and someday I'll choreograph a Broadway show. Right now I'm really happy to do, you know, Rubber Heads and Fur at Disneyland. you know, you never have to be worried about taking Mom to that. So, in closing, Agnes DeMille wrote, and I'm like the quote freak of the universe. I have books and books. Agnes DeMille writes, living is a form of not being sure, not knowing what next or how. The moment you know how, you begin to die a little. The artist never entirely knows. We guess. We may be wrong. But we keep taking leap after leap into the dark. And my hope is that in my life I can continue to just keep taking leap after leap into the dark, and that I'll be like a cat and land somewhere near the lower extremities of my body. Sit on my cat. So, that's all. This is my better half.
Do you need a potty break or...
Time to do it.
Do you want to do it? I don't need one, but... Okay, maybe my wife does. Tell me if you can't hear me, because this mic is distorting a little bit, and that bugs the heck out of me. When I was in college, this really horrible movie came out, The Jazz Singer. It was the third time it had been made, with Neil Diamond and Laurence Olivier, and to this day, film historians have no idea why Laurence Olivier would have been in a movie like that. And he was even Sir Laurence by then. But at that particular place I was in my life, oh, I loved that movie. I think I saw it like 15 times, so it was a little bizarre. But I wanted to be that guy, you know what I mean? And I think it was interesting, though, how I related to him. The big conflict of the story, and it was the same one with Al Jolson and Danny Kaye, was it was a Jewish cantor, and Neil Diamond was actually a rock singer, not a jazz singer, and he moved to Los Angeles to pursue his career as a pop singer, as opposed to staying and being a cantor in his Jewish synagogue and replacing his father. And in his father's eyes, you know, he had nearly denounced his religion and compromised everything that he ever was going to be. Interestingly enough, I think probably part of the reason I liked that movie so much, or I was drawn to it, is I think in the church there's definitely always a conflict, especially when you're doing anything in the arts, especially the entertainment industry, that conflict of how do I do what I want to do so bad in an industry that appears to be so rotten to the core, and yet somehow not sell my soul to the devil. And by the way, I have no answers, so if you think you're going to get any answers tonight, you probably won't. But I found that interesting now, looking back on that so many years ago, how interesting that was to me, and maybe someday I'll have more of some answers. At that point in my life, too, I was so naive and so sheltered. And my feeling now is, if you are one of those black and white Mormons, if you are one of those Mormons where black is black and white is white and there's not a stitch of gray in anything, I don't think you'll be able to have a career in the business. I really don't. Because there comes a point where you have to bend a little bit on certain things, and you have to pick your battles, and you have to, do you know what I mean? I remember even when I first moved to LA, connections are everything in show business. They truly are. I moved to Los Angeles thinking that talent was what was going to get you somewhere in the business. No, I mean, well, I watched The Jazz Singer 15 times. That's what got him, you know. Unfortunately, talent, I don't think, has a lot to do with initial success. It has something to do with it. My hunch is that talent might keep you there a little while, but who knows? It's a goofy business, and it's elusive at very best. I don't know of any other business or industry where you can just work your butt off for 15 years going what you think the path is, and you have not even the slightest incy bit of a guarantee that you're going to even be able to work in it. I'm not meaning to sound bitter, but that is the reality. Don't you agree with me? If you want to be a doctor, yeah, if you go to college for 15 years and do that, chances are pretty good you're going to be a doctor or whatever. But I suppose that's the artist in us, and it has a lot to do with this. You know, you just keep putting it out there in the dark because that's probably what God wants you to do, or you are a masochist, one or the other. Anyway, I think that in this industry, the more things that you say no to, the bigger, the less chances you have. And I don't mean that in a necessarily bad way, because it doesn't mean you won't get any chances. But my experience thus far in my career is that the more things that you say no to, it's going to take longer for things to happen. Now, I've never met David. I absolutely love your movie, by the way. Great movie. That was a great, decent, fun movie with really, well, it was a sleeper, too. Congratulations. So, no, I mean, it's totally awesome. Oh, I mean, our kids still do some of the scenes from it. You know, that was a clean movie with a great moral, but those movies are hard to get done because we live in a society that unfortunately really likes raunchy stuff a lot of times. So it doesn't mean you can't do it and can't be done. I think it just means it takes longer. Now, me personally, I'm a singer and a songwriter and a composer, and I think I was born in the wrong several decades too, you know what I mean? I totally appreciate the kind of music you guys work with, because I have tons of friends that do it. I don't have that in me, though, and I can't do that kind of music. And so that's one more thing, then, that, you know, the less you do, the longer it's going to take, because then you have to find your niche. You have to find your circle of colleagues, perhaps, that have the same values as you. And it can work, but it's always a little bit difficult. I mean, you know, I started out playing in bars and clubs. I at least relaxed a little bit and would do that. That does not bother me. But there are some LDS people that would probably bother them to be around people who are drinking and drunk and picking up each other. But, you know, that's one of those gray areas to me. It's like, oh, well, who cares? If I'm not getting drunk, then it doesn't really matter. I worked for 8 years at Disneyland. I played a show there called The Golden Horseshoe. It was great, but it was very secluded and very safe. Certainly no problems as far as artistically? Are you doing anything that you think is going to compromise your standards? But at the same time, I was working very hard on my songwriting, and I had a publisher, and probably if I had been able to do more types of music or go with stuff that was a little harder edged, it would have given me more venues to pump my stuff. And I don't know if I didn't write that kind of stuff because of my upbringing. It probably did. I think we're all products of how we're brought up, whether we want to admit that or not. Or if it was because I was making a choice, or maybe a combination. I don't want to write stuff that I think might give the wrong impression of who I am. You know, there's always this conflict with the artistic side versus the Asher Lev side. Anybody ever read that Chaim Potok book about this Jewish kid who just was always those Jews and Mormons? We have this guilt thing. But it's very true, though. You go through the, you know, you just have these conflicts of how do I do this thing I want to do more than I want to breathe and not sell my soul to the devil? Then we moved to Nashville, and things were going pretty good. I had a songwriting deal with EMI, and I don't think I had any real problems being LDS there, although they don't particularly love Mormons in the South. But Nashville tends to be a little more cosmopolitan because a lot of people come in from other parts of the country to write. Probably the biggest detriment was not so much that I was LDS, because there are quite a few pretty successful people in the business there, is the fact that I wasn't Baptist, because there is so much great networking that goes on in the good old boy church there. And so that's not a bad thing, it's not a good thing, it's just, you know, the way it is. And back to that networking thing, you know, are you in the right circles? And I talked to a good friend of mine yesterday who is a very successful sound mixer for a lot of very big hit TV shows. And he said, yeah, you can ultimately make it like he has, although he's screwed his work up now, and all the mixers are now going to these, they're being more like production teams where they only work when there's work as opposed to being hired full-time, and he's got kids and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, he said, you can do it. He said, but you aren't able to network sometimes as much as you would because your cronies are going to the strip bars or the bars, or they're going out smoking, you know, on breaks. He said, so what you have to do is ultimately find your group of colleagues who have like-minded values, who are much more interested in the relationships and the work and the process. And that exists. So it's not hopeless and it's not impossible. It just takes a little more time. Right now I'm a music supervisor at the Disneyland Resort, so I do a lot of composing and writing. And as Chris mentioned, I don't have any artistic problems there because it's all family stuff. And as far as work environment goes, it's like everybody's work environment. So, and I don't think my Mormonness is a problem at all. In fact, I'm probably not a very good missionary. My boss keeps giving me a bottle of wine every year for Christmas because I don't think he knows I don't drink or I'm Mormon. So, and we like write together. I mean, we spend hours and hours together. So I guess I need to do a little better job on that. You know, yet to come, I'm working on a musical that looks like if things might happen, and I don't know, you show it to some people and they say, oh, it needs to be harder and there needs to be more darkness in it and the conflict needs to be heavier and all that kind of stuff, and there again, you know, you have to decide, do I do that or do I stick to what is my intuition and all that type of thing, but I think there's a place. I think there's a place for me somewhere, and I don't think the church is necessarily going to keep me back. But I don't have all the answers, and I do think there comes a point in everybody's life, and whether it's whatever you're doing, you might have to kill a Laban somewhere, and I'm not advocating that. But I think maybe everybody's got a Laban that they might have to kill because it has to justify a greater means. Now, I'm not saying, you know, I need to, like, score a porno film because that'll get me in the right, you know, group of people or commit murder or whatever. But I think there's enough gray there that maybe if you're a spiritual enough person and you know this is something you need to do, that whatever you're doing, or I know I might be going to hell for saying this, but it's what I think. Maybe doing that, see this guilt Mormon thing, you know, but maybe doing that is going to create a greater end than the means of that. Do you know what I mean? And so I think it is a case by case thing, and so that's my feeling on the state of the music business and the entertainment business with LDS people.
This has been great. There's a lot of things that I could probably cut out because I'm in agreement with probably each of you on some things. And I want to have to say that I'm really grateful for this opportunity to start thinking about all these things, because I have to say the last couple of weeks since I knew I was going to do this, my mind has just been wheeling, trying to make sense of all this idea of ethics and how I do my work and what I do. And I have to say that the one distinction between what I do and what you, the rest of the panel does, is that I'm a writer. So in the theater, which is my background, the writer is the first cause, in that everything begins with the writer. Nothing, you know, they don't score anything, they don't dance, they don't act until there is a script. So there's a real different sort of a situation that I'm in that no one is telling me to take my clothes off. No one is, you know, I don't have to tell anyone to take my clothes off. It's what I want to do. So that's really good in one way, because no one makes me do anything. But on the other end, I kind of feel like I have the ultimate responsibility for what happens, because it starts with an idea anyway, even if it's something that I start and someone else ends up putting together. What I do is, as a writer in film, I get paid to create fictional scenarios that become films or television productions, hopefully, or plays. And that is kind of a curious place to be making a living. I took a psychology course once, and the professor was being cute, and he said that something like neurotics build castles in the sky and psychotics move into them. And I would add to that screenwriters option them to producers for a lot of money. So it's a strange place to be when your livelihood is dealing with fiction, where you just make things up. And that's somewhat of a rarity in the LDS culture for a couple of reasons. First of all, you know, with the history of the church, the body of the church, with the history of hardship and poverty, and the fact that it was kind of remotely located in Utah for so many years, it's only been a couple of generations where that was even possible, where a member of the church could actually be doing that. And there's also, you know, the whole idea, the whole Victorian notion that the arts are evil and you shouldn't be involved with them. And then also there's just that idea that it's ludicrous to try to make a career in the arts because you'll never make any money. And I have to say that's pretty true, you know. Don't and if anyone is considering that, if you can make a living and be happy as an accountant or a teacher or selling Amway, do it. You know, don't do this. And if you have to, I understand that too, because that's what I had to do, and my condolences to you. So, anyway, I spent a lot of time musing over this idea of ethics and you know, why I do what I do. And why I make the choices I make, the ethical choices I make. Now, my work situation is, it's great. I don't work with anybody. You know, I just have my own little office, and I go there and I write. So, you know, if there's there's a coffee machine in my office, it's my fault. I don't, but it would be. And I would like to make one distinction, and that is the ethics of filmmaking as opposed to the ethics of creating film are two different things. The ethics of producing and financing a film, I would say, as the others here have said, it's business is business. You know, whether you're making a film or whether you're making soap, it's all the same. But that's not what I do. I stay as far away from that as I can, because I don't like that. And that's why writers have agents, you know, so they don't have to. But I think it's interesting to me that we find it that discussions like this take place, where people want to talk about the ethics of the arts. When for me it's always been, I kind of feel like I've taken the easy way out morally, frankly, in a lot of ways. Now I look at a lot of my friends who have become businessmen and lawyers and politicians and things, and I think there are a lot more serious moral pitfalls that a lawyer has to deal with than a guy sitting in front of a word processor. You know, hazardous waste, what do we do with it? not my problem. You know, I don't have to deal with that. My problems are fictional. I'm musing over what makes me make the decisions that I make. How do I choose to put a particular scene or a particular word or a particular theme in a piece that I'm writing? And, you know, I started looking at all these factors that affect me, my personal standards, what is expected of me professionally, the integrity of the piece that I'm working on, my own desire to reflect that real world that Chris mentioned, my desire to create something beautiful or something terrifying or something hilarious, or my desire to make a lot of money or not to embarrass my mother or my wife or my wife's brothers and sisters. That's where the real danger lies. You know, it goes on and on and on. As I was musing and musing, I thought of an example. This is something that really happened in my life, and for that I brought a visual aid that I want to share with you. This is my University of Hell t-shirt. Okay, now, there's a little town in the Cayman Islands called Hell because of the volcanic rock is like real satanic-like. And if you notice the crest, there's like, you know, it looks like a margarita glass and a sailboat and a guy diving and a guy and some dice. Now, most of these things I don't do, or I don't do very well. No, I don't. Anyway, I had one of these shirts about 10 years ago, and I really loved it, and I pretty much wore it out. And then my wife and I took a trip to the Cayman Islands. It was kind of a celebratory trip after Galaxy Quest happened, and I said, I'm going to get me one of these new shirts. So I got myself a new University of Hell shirt. And I came home, and everything was fine until my oldest daughter reached 6, and she started to read. I don't wear this shirt anymore. I realized that my decision-making process about what is appropriate and what I'm going to put in a script is a terribly convoluted thing. And I came to a conclusion that I really didn't expect to come to, and that is that I don't know. I can't tell you exactly what the basis for any given decision is regarding what material I'm going to put in. And what feels good for me today may not feel good tomorrow. What felt good to me 2 weeks ago may not feel good 2 weeks from now. When I came to that conclusion, I kind of went through this crisis. Like, what does this mean? Am I just this moral cipher? do you have no principles? Will you do anything? But then I thought, no, that can't be the case, because if that were the case, my life would be a lot more interesting and a lot more fun. So the real conclusion seemed to me, and I really kind of came to a place of peace at this when I realized that there isn't a real one sentence description or reason that justification that I can make for why I make the choices that I make, that it's a much more complicated process. And for me to try to do that, I would come up with something that is kind of simplistic and not really very valuable to anybody. The truth for me is that it's a very personal process, and it has a lot to do with balancing a lot of different variables and to see where I stand. And it's really kind of as simple and as complicated as a very familiar question that probably most of the people in this room has heard, and that is, are you honest in your dealings with your fellow men? Well, I guess. And there are a lot of ethical questions that I find myself dealing with in those terms. It is very gray, and I agree that you have to be able to deal in those areas if you're going to deal with the arts. Now, along the way, as I was musing along, writers do a lot of musing, they waste a lot of time musing, but it's kind of fun territory to be in. I kind of came across some interesting questions and a few valid arguments that I think are worth sharing, and I could quickly wrap up. I wanted to share some of those. First of all, number one is the idea of cultural pragmatism. Now, We are a pragmatic church. We drink hot chocolate on campouts because you have to drink something on campouts, even if they have caffeine. And if you look at the 11th and 12th Articles of Faith, there are two seemingly contradictory points there. We claim the right to practice our religion as we choose to do so. At the same time, we see ourselves as being subject to kings and presidents, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There is a pragmatism in professing both those views at the same time, because ultimately they could conflict. And it seems to me that the church's approach to the arts is similar in that there is no absolute right or wrong. And I think the way the church responds to the rating system is evidence of that. And I would suggest for you to look at it this way. Now in the church, they'll tell you you can go to G and PG movies, and maybe if you're like on the edge, PG-13 movies, but not R. Now, I find myself thinking, okay, if virtue and beauty is what I'm really all about, why would I even consider PG movies? Why would I not just go to G movies? Now, thank goodness that's not the case, because, you know, you can only see the man from Snowy River so many times. Yeah, and how many times have you seen it? You know you've all seen it. But there is kind of at least an acknowledgement of realism that there is stuff out there that has elements in that you don't necessarily go to see, but you can put up with a little bit of that. And Sean, you're not going to believe this, but I have also quoting the 13th Article of Faith about the idea of something being virtuous and lovely and good report or praiseworthy, and not necessarily all of the above. And I don't think that we are totally parsing the Articles of Faith by saying that they can be different things. And frankly, when Jesus commanded us to be in the world but not of the world, I believe that there are two commandments there. I don't think it is our responsibility or our goal or we're called to totally withdraw ourselves from the things of the world. Which brings me to my next point, which I entitle, What About Saving Private Ryan? Okay, the truth is, we live in an NC-17 world. And people have been writing since Aristotle about how the arts can teach, how we can feel things through the arts that we can't feel anywhere else, and how they educate, and they allow us to see things without having to pay the consequences for them. Regarding the rating system, I have to say, when I start morality in our choices, in what we watch or write or act in, or watch on cable when nobody's looking, and that is what the truth of the piece is that we're watching. I really think that there is a greater morality there. Is what we are seeing really true or not? I think the point of the arts of drama and the narrative arts in any way is that we can see evil for what it is. Now the danger, I think, is when we start showing evil not to be evil. And I think as one of my ultimate responsibilities is, and okay, maybe this will change in a week, I don't know, but right now I think my responsibility as an artist is to represent the truth for what it is. That doesn't mean I can't show it, but it's much more insidious to show evil as being cute or sexy or desirable or without consequences than it is to portray evil as evil. And when you start looking at things in those terms, I think Pretty Woman is a much more insidious film than In the Company of Men, for those of you who've seen that. I think really good art should do that. If it's going to show evil, it should make us sick to our stomach. Now, granted, you may not want that, and you may choose. I'm not advocating that anyone do put anything in any given film, but I think that's a principle that you should stick close to. I frankly, now this is the next issue where things started twisting around. I started thinking about the responsibility of what I do in putting those things in, and I have to tell you, I do not think that Shakespeare is trapped in the spirit prison because he created Iago or Richard III. No, no, no. No one said that. No one ever said that. Okay. I never heard that in priesthood, okay? And I don't think Alfred Hitchcock is in hell, you know, for all those delicious things he did with those birds. I just don't think that's the case.
How about Woody Allen?
well, not for his movies. Okay.
Okay.
So, I'm thinking about what my responsibility is as a writer. And a good friend of mine who is Jewish once told me what his rabbi had said. And I think it's voicing the idea of restraint. And he set up this hierarchy where he said, you don't have to say everything you think. You don't have to write everything you say. And you don't have to publish everything you write. And I think there's a certain reality there that makes a lot of sense. And restraint is a good thing. And frankly, you know, if you read Aristotle, restraint can sometimes be much more chilling and terrifying and disturbing than actually, you know, a graphic presentation of those things. But that started me thinking, just how responsible am I for what I do? And, you know, I start musing and I'm going off. And are these gangster rappers, are they responsible for this society of violence that we live in, or are they victims of it? And what if I'm so lucky as to never publish anything? So what if I write all these horrible things and no one ever reads it? Am I absolved of what I've done wrong? I don't know. Or is there some kind of like this reverse multi-level accountability thing where... Like if I come up with a play with some like lewd ideas and raunchy images, and have this little equity waiver production in Hollywood, and 300 people come to see it, does that make me like a junior associate sinner? Whereas if this play gets optioned and produced by Paramount, and 100 million people see it, does that like make me, you know, the senior vice president of corruption or something? I don't know. But if it is the case, there's probably a lot of filmmakers driving pink Cadillacs in hell, we can be sure of that. But the point about theater is that it is fiction, and for fiction to hurt you, someone else has to participate in it. That's one place where I feel that we're on safe ground. Another thing that kind of became clear to me was the idea of judging the artist by the work that they do. Now, I started looking at all these variables and all these things that go into my choices, and I realized that it's very private, and I don't think even the people who know me the best don't know what's going on in here. You know, this is a scary place, and consequently, I have no idea what is going on in David Mamet's head or Tom Stoppard's head or Neil LaBute's head, and while I will make choices whether I want to see those pieces, and I should make intelligent choices about those. We're given some pretty strict counsel about judging others, and I think it's important to judge works and not judge artists because of their works, because they're not the same thing. The final question that I was thinking about was, what about those really fun movies that don't particularly teach anything? What about Star Wars? What about, you know, all those stormtroopers getting mowed down? You know, is that some horrible... violent image that is going to warp people? And what about the pointlessness? Is that sin? What about frivolity? What about entertainment or escapism or frivolity or, you know, chills and thrills and titillation? What about all those things? What about all those emotional angels that are dancing on the head of the pin of guilt and justification that all we artists have to deal with? I took one more look around, and I kind of decided to put this in the context of the world, and I came to a conclusion. And this is just me talking, obviously, but it's pretty clear in our gospel that we are meant to be creatures of joy, and I don't think joy means, you know, sitting around with a glassy-eyed smile on your face and ignoring what is around you. I don't think that's the purpose, and I think this world is a lesson. Is a place where we're supposed to learn a lot of lessons for a lot of reasons, and you know, you have to believe that the God that created the platypus and the hedgehog and the dung beetle had some sort of a sense of humor. If he have created the scorpion and the leopard and the anaconda, he must have had some sort of an appreciation for lethal efficiency. To make the house fly and the mosquito, he must have understood irritation. You know, if he made the dog and the horse, he understands loyalty. And I am convinced that our Father in Heaven has a real soft spot for drama, or else he wouldn't have made Blood Red. He would have made it taupe or Bane. Anyway, those are my thoughts. It's a convoluted process, but the great thing about the arts is you get to create, and that is what God does, and that is one of the things that we're here to learn. And those are my thoughts. Thanks.
All right, we're running a little over our normal time, so we'll have time for a few questions, and then we'll wrap up. Yep.
I wanted to ask Mr. Utley, am I pronouncing your
name
correctly?
That is correct.
You asked rhetorically if you thought the industry in which you worked was immoral. Do you think it's immoral? I certainly do. Especially television. I don't think you can find a primetime television program that has a moral point of view, with the exception of maybe Touched by an Angel.
It's challenging as the father of two daughters to constantly monitor their television viewing habits. It's very challenging. I believe that there are a bunch of very vocal people in the industry who are whose morals, they don't subscribe to the same values that I do, and probably that you do. For me to answer that question, I have to answer it because moral or immoral is something that belongs to a person. So I have to say that a lot of people in the industry are immoral, and they are creating a lot of dangerous material and a lot of inappropriate material and material that I personally don't subscribe to. Is entertainment itself immoral? I spoke very clearly that I don't believe entertainment is immoral, and there are many, many lesser heard voices creating very uplifting material and very valuable and rich and growth-inducing material. And for whether the others just have a louder voice, or there are more of them, or we just gravitate towards the more intriguing nastiness, I don't know. But I haven't given up on the industry, because I see good product come out often enough that right now I choose to stay in it.
What is your opinion about R-rated movies? Are you think they're all really bad and should be avoided? I thought my favorite movies are R-rated.
I appreciate the question, and I'll pass on answering that. because that gets into a realm of personal opinion that I don't want to get into in this forum. Yeah.
I just wanted to say, I want to start a new war now. When are you guys to the bishop?
Oh, no.
No.
Sean, what label are you working
on? It's called Nitro Records. Little, we have punk rock music. So your children would like it, you probably wouldn't.
Any other questions?
I actually work in the high tech industry, I'm a fan, and a lot of content that we're seeing pushed out is being driven by advertising. So, I mean, we're pretty mainstream, but there's a lot of stuff out on the internet that if it sells, people pay for it, it's going to be produced now. And what lessons have you learned in your industry where it's a little more personal, where you can see your customer, you can see your colleagues, that we could take back into our industry? I think we're moving as a country towards the entertainment economy, so it's not going to be the artificial separation between your industry and the rest of us. What can we learn? What's coming down the line?
just kind of maybe what this, I have no idea how to answer the question, but my one thought would be, as that happens, like, as it happens, I think there's all of a sudden no more art. I mean, we're talking, and David talked a lot about, you know, art, and when it gets to there, like you said, it's an, you know, an entertainment economy, and all of a sudden it is no art, it is advertising, and that is blurring, and for me, that's not what I'm, you know, interested in. But yeah, that I definitely see that happening. I forget your main question, and one of the other ones could probably help you with that specific question. But there's my thought.
You know, that's the one thing that I would take exception to. The if you look at the top 50 grossing films of all time, I think like 45 of them are PG or G. And I was really impressed after Galaxy Quest was produced. I had a lot of meetings with producers who were looking for that sort of thing. And what the phenomenon that is interesting to me is that the culture that exists here in this city and in the coasts is, I mean, they've done studies and they've shown that it's much, their morality is very different from the rest of the country. So a lot of the television choices are made by people who live in these places where the mores are different. What is right and what is wrong is very different. But ultimately, these big markets, what they want to sell to, they want these crossover things that are going to sell tickets or get viewers that will be to people, you know, in the big cities, but also in all this flyover country, whom, frankly, a lot of the people in Los Angeles don't understand. They don't get it. And I think there are a lot of people, business people in Hollywood, who want family-friendly programming that isn't going to insult intelligent audiences. So I think that anyone who can do that, I think that's a good place to be financially, because I think there are a lot of people. I think that is just a sound business place where you look at all the major cities. Look what has done well. Harry Potter, you know, Lord of the Rings. Those things. Okay, Lord of the Rings is kind of intense, but. But I mean, and certainly if you want a message of, you know, some sort of a moral of some kind, it's certainly in there. But that there really are markets for those sorts of things, and I don't think you should give up on the on if you're pursuing it on the business because you don't think that there's a need for that, because I really think that there is.
Regarding the recent Supreme Court decision saying that movies, as long as they don't use children to produce them, what are your views on that decision? Do you agree with that, or do you agree with the attorney? The
court was mentioning, you know, if it's going to stop things like Romeo and Juliet from being produced, then that's where they saw the problem being. So there's, you know, pornography I don't back at all, but there, you know, can be art or things made that kind of fall on that line. So I kind of agree with the Supreme.
Let me explain. I think what they said was that as long as children are not used in the production of something, then it's legal. They can use magical things, electronic stuff to produce things, as long as they don't use children in the production of it.
In those cases, no actual children were acting in those programs, and they had older people who were adults that appeared to be children, or electronic computer-generated images that appeared to be children. But they thought that it was in the interest of free speech in that situation to that you couldn't curb free speech or you would greatly diminish other examples.
Anyone else want to respond to the decision?
Well, that's a big old heavy
topic. Yeah. We want to answer.
There was one other question.
I mean,
I was just
going to
ask, have you got your script
accepted?
Because I don't
know. No. I almost hesitate telling the story because what happened to me is like 1 in 10,000, and when I tell it, people think it can happen to them, and I don't want that responsibility. But what happened was I gave it to a friend of mine who, frankly, who incidentally is a member of the church, who had worked in a company called Beacon Pictures. Her name is Sona Gregura. She's a good member of the church. She lives in Colorado now, and she... I didn't have an agent. I wasn't represented. I was really on the fringes of things. And we were in the same ward. We'd been in the singles ward together, and we'd both gotten married, not to each other, but we were friends. And the four of us were having dinner one night, and I said, "Sona, I have these scripts. Would you take a look at them for me?" And she read them, and she said, "I think someone might be interested in producing these." So she said, "Could I option them from you?" And that's like, you know, a non-money option, really. It's just like, since I'm your friend, maybe I can shop it around, maybe we can get this thing going. And I said, sure, because there wasn't anyone knocking my door down. So she went back to the company that she had worked, Beacon Pictures, and talked to the woman who had taken her place after she had quit working. She quit working because she wanted to have children. And partnered with a woman there named Suzanne Ellis. And just as luck would have it, I gave a copy of the script to a friend of mine who was in development in a company in Salt Lake City, and he sent it to an agent and I happened to be on vacation, and this agent, not knowing that it was optioned, started talking to producers around town because he really liked it. And I came back from Hawaii, and he was very interested, and he called me, and I said, "Well, it's optioned. Do you realize that?" And he freaked out, and I felt terrible because I had to say, "You can't have it. I don't own it." And then he called me back and said, "Listen, do these people, do they have any money? What can they do with it?" And I said, "They would love to talk to you about it." And then this woman, Suzanne Ellis, she called. She was in development, so she talked to all the people at the agency. So she called her contact at CAA and said, "Look, I've got this script, and this producer's really hot on it. Do you want to read it over the weekend?" And from there, it got to the studios, and they liked it. And it was one of those deals where it went to an agent who was a new agent. He'd been there about a year, and he really wanted to sell something. And from there, it went to like a first-year executive at DreamWorks who really wanted to get a deal, something going. And from there, it went to two production companies that both were really rushing to try to get something going with DreamWorks. And then DreamWorks looked at their movies and said, "You know, we're not making any movies. We got to get something going here." So it was like all the doors just happened to be open, and my script came through the door at the right time. So that's how it happened.
Thanks again to all of our panelists for a really great discussion this evening.
In the 80s, when I had my rock and roll band, but singing a little bit different kind of lyric, and it's just been a constant evolution for me, and this is what I've come up with. The great thing about being a musician, though, in this day and age, is that you can be an independent artist, and you can tour the country. I've traveled around and have my little grassroots fan base and sell your CDs on the internet and just self-distribute. And if you have a really lot of money, you could even promote yourself on radio. But anyway, this is a song I wrote kind of inspired about our pioneer forefathers and foremothers crossing the plains. It's called Over That Hill. But even greater than the plague of persecution,
especially be compassionate with those that we disagree with, and help us that we can be able to hear both their words and the feelings in their hearts. We pray, Father, that as we go to our homes or our places to stay this evening, we will go safely. We pray that we can enjoy each other's company again tomorrow and express our love unto thee for the complex and fascinating and wonderful experience that is our mortal existence. And we say these things in the name of Jesus Christ.